Hello, everyone. I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. The programme is dedicated to Captain Sir Tom Moore, a veteran of the Burma campaign, a quiet, unassuming hero whose unflinching, unquestioning and ever loyal service to the nation is an example to us all. My guest on this month's edition of General Talk is General the Lord Richards of Hurst Monceux, a fine soldier with a reputation as a most capable Chief of the Defence Staff until his retirement in 2013. Active on the world stage and as a crossbencher in the House of Lords, we began our conversation by taking stock.
We are a year into a pandemic that has subdued and hobbled the world, yet underneath the tensions are still bubbling nicely away, Iraq, Afghanistan to name but two. We welcome President Biden to the White House. President Putin's hold on the Kremlin seems no less secure despite the efforts of Alexei Navalny. Close to home, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced an increase in defence spending of 0.5% above GDP, never mind that has dropped by over 20%. Our army deployed in operations in Afghanistan, Iraq and now Mali, while the Navy seems incapable of controlling profligate defence costs. We are now out of the EU. They're not necessarily out of the woods, diplomatically speaking. What is your take, David, on Britain's standing on the world stage today?
First of all, I would say, you know, even in respect of President Putin, it's not in our interests. And, you know, as an old soldier, I would say this, wouldn't I, to wish for instability in any country. I know that's not what you're suggesting, but you talked about him being stable. From a very realpolitik perspective, we want Russia to be stable. We don't want an unstable Russia. In a way, we know and understand what Russia is doing. It's what Russia always has done. We're not so good at parlying with them as we used to be. The stick and carrot seems to have disappeared in part because we don't have a big enough stick, and I'm sure we'll come back to that collectively. China, I think you didn't actually mention, but is very big on people's radar. I've said for some years, and you've heard me say this, but for me the biggest geostrategic issue of our time is how well, sometimes I use the word gracefully, will the USA learn to accept China's inevitable, ultimately probably dominance on the world stage. And she's very nearly there already economically. And I'm not certain that we should be too sanguine about that. So there are all sorts of risks out there. But I think as long as we get that balance of carrot and stick, and are always, as one of my American friends call it, looking for ramp-offs or ramps off away from confrontation and the risk or ultimately of war, and find areas in which we can cooperate, which there will be many, because China, as an example, does not want to be unstable. The Chinese Communist Party want a stable and contented population. That's their highest priority. Well, without our involvement and our buying things from them and all the other things, they won't achieve that. So there's plenty of things that we can put into this mixture that allows us to have influence and work together while being strong on those areas that we find, and there won't be that many in my judgment, but those areas which we find are impossible. But it's a very delicate world we're in at the moment. I'm pleased about the Prime Minister's increase in defence expenditure, but as you also said, that's on the back of many years of cutting. And to look at an army, I think, over the next 2 or 3 years being cut to the 60,000s, I don't know where yet, and the growth of a maritime strategy, which I'm not necessarily against, but I suspect largely for industrial reasons, as opposed to military strategic reasons, I'm worried. So I don't think we put enough into defence yet, and we need to readdress that issue once we get this much vaunted integrated review published.
Do you think that the Prime Minister, given the level of borrowing, do you think he's able to hold to that promise of this increase in defence spending?
Well, I think he's got no option now. And I would, congratulate my successors amongst the chiefs and indeed the defence secretary, ex-soldier. But they've done well for us there. But as I said, to not have put more into defence within the sort of great cry of global Britain would have been a complete mockery of political hype. So I'm not surprised they did it. They had no option. They would have been called out nationally and internationally. But to answer your question, I think he's got to stick by it, not least because for genuine strategic issues, but also because to backtrack now would be politically extremely damaging for him. And I'm confident, I know Boris Johnson, reasonably well. I'm absolutely convinced he means what he says. But the other reason I'm confident is amongst the huge amount of money that we're currently spending, understandably, on combating COVID, the extra money they're putting in defence is relatively small, actually. And so I think it'll, to some degree, be lost in the noise.
You talk about the primacy, as it were, or the upcoming primacy of China on the global stage. Of course, as I think, if I'm right in saying, they have built or they are building 8 carriers. Do you think, despite my quip about the inability of the Royal Navy to control the profligate cost of their defence spending, that actually the good news amongst all this is that perhaps our two wonderful aircraft carriers, HMS Queen Elizabeth and HMS Prince of Wales, therefore are secure in their future?
Well, again, I think one reason such a big proportion of the defence budget is going to go into the Royal Navy and into their equipment programme is that those carriers are now built. And I had severe misgivings about the wisdom of procuring them back in the late 2000s, early 2010-12 when I was CDS. And they were nearly axed. There was serious consideration given to that. But the decision was taken to go ahead, right or wrong. We have now got to make virtue of necessity. And I'm sure our comrades in the Royal Navy will rightly do that. I have a huge admiration for them. And indeed, if I hadn't had rotten eyesight, I might well have been a sailor, not a soldier.
I concur.
I think as far as those carriers concerned, I'm waiting to hear confirmation that they expect to have 2 on operations at the same time. That was never the intention. They weren't manned to do that. To allow one always to be available. And even then there were projected gaps. So if we are going to have 2, and I hear the Navy want to do that, I understand why they want to do that, that's going to be another big whack of spending that has to go on the Navy. I would quickly say strategically, my own view is that we should use our carriers along with the French carrier closer to home, allowing the USA to be the principal deterrent to Chinese aggression or recklessness in Southeast Asia. My own view is it makes little strategic sense for the Royal Navy to a very limited degree, but with great risk potentially to go off to the Pacific and to the South China Sea and all those sort of things, where they'll be utterly dependent on the US Navy for their protection, unless we were to ignore the challenges closer to home and in the Mediterranean, Atlantic and in the Gulf, which I think should be our defence priority, while allowing America as a result to put more relative effort into looking after the Chinese issue.
We have perhaps therefore a resurgent Royal Navy, which is a great thing to see. Reports in the press are that Poor old General Sir Nick Carter is not going to be extended in role as CDS. Do you think, therefore, we'll have a possibility an Abra as CDS in the next position?
Well, first of all, I think whether he is or not, in one sense, is neither here nor there. I don't think to do that job for more than 3 years is necessarily wise. However brilliant Nick Carter is, there's some very, very good people coming along behind. And if someone stays longer in the job, it means that probably at some point, certainly, one or two very good people are not going to be able to contribute to the armed forces and to the country in the way we would want. His time is up, I think, in June. And that would be the right moment, I think, unless there's a reason, you know, stay on for a few months because of a particular project or something. But that would be the right time on balance for him to go. And he's done a brilliant job. But whether it should be a naval officer, no, look, that really, at that level, is not, I don't think it should be an issue. I mean, if you are going to be CDS, you jolly well should understand jointry. And you're there for your strategic insights and wisdom, not because you favour a particular cloth. And if you want expertise in that particular area, there's plenty of people who you know you can trust. So you should be the best man from a military strategic perspective, the best leader in the judgment of the Prime Minister, and the person who will have most clout on the international stage too, very important. Ideally, that person has to have operational experience too, because when you're sitting in the cabinet room or the National Security Council is sitting, the one thing that distinguishes the CDS from all the others sitting in that room is that he knows what it's like to be on operations, or he should. If he can't bring that moral advantage to the debate, then he's probably not going to be as powerful, however intelligent and all the rest he might be.
One of the comments made by General Sir James Everard in last month's general talk was that he felt that Britain, the United Kingdom, had lost its ability to think strategically. This is a pet subject that you and I discussed many times. How do you think we give our generals and admirals and air chief marshals that strategic ability once again?
I think as a country, we find it very difficult. All countries do, at least those who are beset by political intrigue and democratically validated ambition. In this day and age, the media, 24-hour media, social media, all these things play on our political leaders in a way their predecessors never had the disadvantage of experiencing. And I think that is not helpful. But then also, James, I think, is right. However much you train people, in the case of the military, even they find it difficult when they go into an environment where political gain and calculation is the key. If it happens to be strategically as well, then that's a bit of a bonus. So I believe, and I said this a lot as I got more senior, and I remember having a long conversation with David Cameron about it, I believe that they should go through a training course. It may only be a couple of exercises early on in their time, crisis games, those sort of things would be very helpful. And if you think about it, that's what our prime ministers did right through the Cold War. Those big exercises, I remember taking part in as a colonel in the when Maggie Thatcher was prime minister. And indeed, then again, when John Major was doing it, and they would be put through their paces, and Maggie Thatcher was very clear she needed to be. That doesn't happen. They're all above it. I did recommend it to Secretary of State when I was CDS, didn't get anywhere. They seem to think that it was questioning their wisdom and experience and so on. So I think that's another area that we could put them under great pressure to do a bit of. It wouldn't necessarily solve the issue, though, because I think we're in a much more a world in which it's going to be much harder. But let's see what President Biden is like. He's got the age and experience and wisdom to do better at this. And as long as people around him encourage it, I'm quite confident things will improve.
I think the idea of ministerial training and prime ministerial training is a great notion and a great proposal. I just dread to think of the unseemly scramble as endless streams of retired generals scrabble to get the contract. But let's move on to the discussion about our army today. 83,000, we are not able to meet that recruiting target. Do you think it is a well-rounded force as a national capability?
Well, it's too small. I mean, it's the real figure, I believe, at the moment is in mid-70s. The target is 80. I think recruiting has gone up. That's, as ever, is the case in a difficult economic environment. But how really motivated a lot of those young people are who are joining the armed forces are, you know, is always a question of doubt. What it always intrigues and pleases me is how recruiting goes up when we're in the middle of wars. Now, that I like to think is attracting the right sort of soldier, sailor, airman. You know, they're the ones that want to do the business as opposed to just get a job. So there's a little bit of a worry I have on quality. And anecdotally, I know that is worrying people. There's a lot more psychological problems amongst the younger recruits being reported up the medical chain, for example. So even if the numbers are going up, is our system up to managing the type of person joining the army? I think the vast majority are fine, but that would worry me. But it's this sort of notion that really felt largely by politicians and the liberal intelligentsia that if we possibly can avoid getting entangled in things abroad, then we ought to. And all we should do is really train others to do it and you know, operate via proxies and all this sort of thing. Well, at the end of the day, I think the armed forces will start to not disintegrate, but lose the moral fibre that makes the British Armed Forces rather special, i.e. a preparedness to fight and the knowledge that they might well be called upon to fight. And you and I know of armies that don't possess that, some quite close to home, and you don't really want to be alongside them in the next door trench under pressure, do you?
But I think no names, no pack drills, but don't drink sherry. The recent conflict in Armenia with Azerbaijan has proven perhaps that the days of armour, thanks to drone action, devastating drone action, are over. In this review, this is a radical opportunity to look at how our armed forces should look. Do you think, therefore, that we should have a complete review and examine whether keeping two regiments of tanks, which is hardly worth the bother, frankly, is an idea that we should abandon altogether, and armour should be swept aside in the name of drone technology?
Well, no, I don't. The problem that, and I have total confidence that, although it'll be jolly difficult to get the balance right, my successors, the current CGS and so on, and his counterparts in the other services, will basically get this right. But the issue at a higher level, and I can come back to the particulars, but the issue at a higher level is we're in a period of transition from, if you like, the mechanical age that you and I remember well, and I spent, you know, first 20 years of my professional life being part of in Germany, a mass armoured manoeuvre. Hundreds, I mean, what the younger generation don't know even is that we used to have hundreds of thousands of troops deployed on those big NATO exercises in Germany. And at the tactical, you know, well, it was very special. And at the tactical level, Actually, although we got a bad press, it was pretty good. I think at the operational level, until General Ginge Bagnall came along, the tactics were a little arid. But actually, overall, that period was a great success. And I'm always minded of Sun Tzu's dictum that the acme of military skill is to defeat your enemy without firing a shot. And that's exactly what that generation achieved in respect of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. I always think maybe, given the way medals are rather more freely distributed at the moment, but one that should have been issued was to that generation that won the Cold War, because actually they did a lot more, sadly, I think, than some people do today to put a gong on their chest, yet another gong on their chest. Anyway, that's a particular bleep from that generation, and not because I want any more, but I just feel, you know, they haven't really been acknowledged in the way they should have been. But the reason I'm mentioning that is that we're moving from that era to something that some people call an information era. And sadly, you can't just chuck out all the old, expecting it to be replaced by the new overnight. We're going to have a balance of military assets from both eras that might increasingly favour the new. But I can tell you, as tactical and technical pendulums swing, and while drones are very important and will be increasingly in our panoply of weapons, there will be counter technology developed, and you cannot seize and hold ground with drones, for example. You still need to be able to maneuver and defend. And I'm very mindful of the total failure, despite their huge acquisition means, of NATO aircraft to find Serbian tanks in Serbia and Kosovo back in the 90s. Now, you know, the drone technology has made all that easier. I'm the first to admit and concede we must get faster on the front foot in that area. But don't chuck the baby out with the bathwater yet, would be my advice. And that is one reason, by the way, Harry, that we need to put more money yet into defence. There's a real risk that we chuck out things like tanks, some artillery, armoured infantry and so on, before the new technology has taken their place, and our soldiers will be very unprotected in some war that inevitably will come along, but our politicians were convinced would never happen.
You mentioned the need to put more into defence spending. One of the closing comments of General Sir Mike Jackson, who was the last president of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, before handing over to General Sir James Everard, was that he estimated we could put two brigades into the field today. Many say that is probably a very generous estimate. Given that, let's say, we can put a good strong brigade plus in the field now, that's hardly going to cut any mustard on the world stage. So what's your view on that?
Well, that would be a fighting brigade able to deploy on operations. Of course, our influence can be felt through the deployment of battalion and company level size forces, not necessarily into conflict, but to support our allies and so on. So you don't necessarily buy influence purely by the size of one's contribution to a war. But that said, I know, as I go around the world still, that lots of eyes are on the ability of the British Army only to deploy about a brigade. And I think, you know, sometimes because of, amateurs taught tactics, professionals taught logistics, sustainability, stocks, all that sort of thing, are an area that I think we don't put enough focus on. Certainly, they've been depleted. So how long can you sustain an operation, even at brigade level, would be a question mark. I have actually engineered that question in the House of Lords a couple of years ago, and got a very unsatisfactory answer, by the way. I think sometimes the civil servants feed answers to our political leaders, think we're all numpties. We've been there ourselves. So but that's a particular worry. But I think, it is where we are, where we are. It's why I believe we must build back the army, perhaps, as we just said, speaking to some, changing what the structure and the composition, to reflect drone technology and swarm tech and so on. But it is why our alliances are so important, Harry. So, because most nations are struggling and at the moment, and I can't see this changing, NATO is fundamental to our security. I don't hear enough about NATO, both within the armed forces, by the way, but also in the context of global Britain. It's why military strategically, I would focus British efforts now at that war fighting level almost exclusively on NATO as we used to, and not worry about contributing to what might happen in Southeast Asia and the Pacific against the putative Chinese threat. As I said earlier, I would allow the Americans, while successfully persuading their allies in NATO to put more effort into NATO, we included, and our record is pretty good compared with most, I would do that so that they can put more relative effort towards the Far East. So it's a combination of solutions, but I think the bottom line is we aren't putting enough into defence. We want to have the leadership role that we seek in this global Britain that we're entering, an era of global Britain. We've got to put more money into defence, and a two-brigade division, war-fighting division, re-equipped in whatever way we all agree, but that is genuine and not ersatz. And I see too many military people putting together combinations of vehicles that quite clearly wouldn't be fightable. And yet, talking up what we've got, that's not good either. So we've got to really, be very strict with ourselves, look at history, analyze what's coming down the road, and then put together something that you and I would recognize as a two brigade war fighting division. And that, from that core, which would be at the heart of the army, and able to deploy quickly, and because readiness is key. And then we really have got something rather special compared to the rest of our NATO allies.
One of the issues that we face currently is that a number of our servicemen and women come from outside the United Kingdom, specifically the Commonwealth and Southern Africa. In your role as Grand President of the Royal Commonwealth Ex-Services League, what is your take on the anomaly of service that the Commonwealth veteran, in some cases, who has served and fought for our country in our name, is not able to qualify for citizenship or has to pay in excess of £2,500, having in some cases been severely wounded or just indeed fought valiantly on our behalf?
Well, I think you know the answer to that. I'm persistently disappointed by our governments, successive governments' inability to see the wood for the trees on this. But when we are accepting immigrants on the scale that we do, surely we should put our servicemen and women from Commonwealth countries at the very top of the list of those that can come. Now, to some degree, the Home Office now get that, although not in all respects, is my judgment. But to then ask them to pay that amount of money for the privilege of coming to live in the country they fought and defended, or at least been prepared to, I think is absolutely out of order. And we've got to continue to do something about it. Although the Royal Commonwealth Ex-Services League does not exist primarily to do that, it's obviously our job is to look after veterans who actually fought for the crown pre-independence. We do take on behalf of the single service charities and the British Legion a big advocacy and charitable role with those people from the Commonwealth, and we'll continue to do that.
We're all in lockdown. Inevitably, we are hampered in our ability to do as much as we would like to do and to travel the world as you routinely do. What keeps the Richards family going in the long hours and winter nights at home on the South Coast, given that you can't do all the things you like to do normally?
Well, I sort of spend quite a lot of time sort of thinking about those things, and I'm very lucky that I have got a boat, which is berthed not very far from our house, and I go down there occasionally and potter around and do a bit of making and mending. I do a lot of House of Lords stuff, which you can now do virtually. But most importantly, I look forward to seeing the smiles on people's faces as they go back to living the life that we all are in this world to do if we're lucky enough.
And on that uplifting note of cheery smiles on people's faces, my thanks to Lord Richards for being my guest on General Talk. If, like Brigadier Robin Bacon, our Chief of Staff, you always have room for a curry, then please visit soldierscharity.org to learn about the Lord Mayor's Big Curry 2021, which I'm told is not just a lunch, but virtual events and activities to support our veterans into employment. On the other hand, if your idea of an Anne is a nice old lady watching TV in the comfort of her sitting room, then perhaps we can tempt you with a Friday night in, as a Soldiers' Charity lure you away from Netflix on Friday the 5th of March for dinner with, among others, Claire Balding and John Simpson, and music from the Royal Edinburgh Military too. Well, virtually anyway. It's all on the line at soldierscharity.org. From me, Harry Botnell, locked safely away here in Dorset, it's farewell and thank you for listening. With studio editing by Michael Ciliano, this has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity. Someone told me that Martin Rutledge is making prawn cocktails for the 5th of March. Anybody heard that?